Good afternoon, Occupy Boston. Hey, it's nice to be here. This is falling. Hang on. I'm gonna slosh a little bit. Good afternoon, it's beautiful weather. It's always a pleasure to be at Occupy Boston. It's especially a pleasure to be here today, hosting today's lecture in the Howard Zinn Memorial Lecture Series. Today's speaker is Professor Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, who I'm sure many of you are familiar with her long-standing work in this country on the left with SDS, with the women's movement, with the anti-war movement, with indigenous peoples movements, with the labor movements. We're really, really quite lucky to have Professor Dunbar Ortiz here with us. She's a professor of history, and it's just such a treat to have her with us. Please, please help me welcome her to Occupy Boston.
There's a hole in this soapbox.
There's a couple of them.
Thank you. I was warned that there's a hole. It's so good to be here and to see this. I visited a few Occupies. Of course, I'm in the Bay Area. We have a notorious one now, a heroic one, Oakland. Yay! Oakland. And San Francisco, we have a smaller one, but one that's very militant. And I went to Baltimore, Washington, D.C. There are two, Oklahoma, Oklahoma City, Tulsa. I'm from Oklahoma. So I am so excited about what you're doing, and as a 60s veteran, you probably know, most of you are younger, but how there's one of mine, how we've been grumbling all these years, why don't these young people do something, and not providing maybe as much leadership as we could have, but we're definitely all fired up and ready to support in any way we can and be a part of it. And it's not a passing thing. I mean, this is what we might call, you know, the beginning that we should see no end to. One of the things I learned in my younger days, you know, beginning to be, I call myself a revolutionary then. It seems a little hyperbolic now to call myself a revolutionary, but radical, whatever, very politically radical. We had access to the Vietnamese who were fighting the United States. We would meet with them in various foreign countries like Canada, Montreal, Vancouver. Some went to Czechoslovakia and other places, and some went to Vietnam. I didn't. And what they always emphasized, two things they emphasized to us. One is that they had fought for 1,000 years, generation to generation, and that it's a culture of resistance. And that if we didn't think that way, we would constantly be disappointed and dispirited when there were lows, when it looked like nothing was happening, when the enemy was getting stronger and stronger. The other thing I learned from them was you must love your own people. As many of us were became very resentful. They especially emphasized that we had to love our own soldiers who were victims and not the enemy. And so I think if we remember some fundamentals like that or learn them, and let them guide us, we'll be much stronger and understand it's the long haul. It's not every, you know, all the media and the powers that be, they want to know the demands. What are the demands? What do you want? I want a list, you know, and I think the brilliance of this movement is it's very clear what the demands are. But if you enumerate them, then you leave out people, the 99%, because it's a big umbrella and there are many, many things. If you start listing them, then it diminishes the principle of people's power, of collective mutual aid, of caring for each other. And what you've developed is a witness to that, an example of that. This is what we want, is people together, people helping each other, a caring society. And if those fundamentals, everything after that comes, like free health care, adequate housing, education, it's just that's how it has to be, based on those principles. Well, I want to say before I forget that I am proud to be on this soapbox that is in the name of Howard Zinn, the memory of Howard Zinn, and that it's the lecture series named after him. Howard was a really good friend of mine and a mentor for the past 40 years. And I miss him terribly. He's the most generous person I think I ever met. He and Noam Chomsky, sort of the twins of the Boston area, the Giants, who are, Noam is also a mentor of mine for 40 years. And I heard he spoke here first, and that makes sense. So I feel very humble being on this soapbox and also energized and just wishing Howard could be here to see this. He wouldn't be surprised, actually, as many people were, because he always had faith in people, especially young people, and never, ever said, why isn't someone doing this or that? You know, he just set an example. And that's what we all have to do, I think. Well, I wanted to, you know, they asked me for a name for what I was going to say today. So I said, kind of the obvious, the city on the hill. But I added to it where it all began. So I guess, you know, the upshot of what I want to say is that Wall Street began right here in the city on the hill with the Puritans, with the initial settlement of the country. It began with colonialism, began with British imperialism, that the United States then broke away from. And I say, you know, it broke away from in the same way that South Rhodesia broke away from Rhodesia once it was going to become an independent Zimbabwe. It broke away as an independent oppressive state instead of a... And we have a lot of rhetoric and brainwashing about how we have to think about the United States. And because I come from a Native American perspective, an indigenous perspective, I can never see it that way. And I don't think there can be two things that are right. One story, the official story, and the indigenous story. I think we have to accept that the indigenous story is the correct history of the United States. And right now, I was, you know, actually challenged by Beacon Press to write this book called Indigenous Perspective on the History of the United States. And it is a real challenge to write this down. And it's such a depressing story, really, really not upbeat. But I think it, in a way, I think the truth is always upbeat, because it's better to be living with reality and seeing what you're working with and why we've been so unsuccessful with so many movements. You look back in the last, as Howard accounts in his People's History of the United States, just read that book and see the many, many constant struggles, huge. People dying for workers' rights, people, Black Panthers assassinated almost half their numbers, American Indian Movement, same thing. And from the beginning, you have my most exemplary, to me, the most exemplary movement was the abolitionist movement. And to me, that is the essence of what should be the history of Beacon Hill, of Boston, the city on the hill, is the abolitionists were, this was headquarters for the most radical abolitionist movement, William Lloyd Garrison, Frederick Douglass, the Grimke sisters, Sojourner Truth. And so I began thinking of an alternate history. I've been proposing this for a long time in a lot of places, and we have a kind of free university thing beginning in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it's one of the things we want to do. We have a labor fest there, which we celebrate the general strike of 1934, the 1946 Oakland general strike, and now we'll forever be celebrating the Occupy movement. But we also try to dig deep into labor, the labor of the Indians, the mission of the Indians that the Franciscans missionized and made into slaves, those quaint little missions all along the California coast on the El Camino de Real, the Royal Highway. The center of each one of those was a whipping post, and they built all the churches and the cathedrals. What about that labor, you know? So. Excavating, going, drilling deeper. And one thing you'll find not going very far, very long, given the history of Boston, is the abolitionist movement. And when I got involved in the civil rights movement, because I was also a historian, I saw it as very much a parallel of the abolitionist movement. And only beautifully, it was immediately led by African Americans, of course, and that was a great power. Abolitionist movement was started by William Lloyd Garrison, was a printer, was a laborer, and really was started by several labor organizations who, pre-Marx, this was in the 1820s, 1830s, pre-socialism, communism, saw capital as the enemy, capitalism, and that the working people, their wages were undercut by free labor, which is really what slave labor is free. You know, you don't pay them anything, not even their upkeep. They had to raise their own gardens, their own food, and that for their owners. So they were free labor. And this hurt the workers. So that was the first nudge, and I think we forget those connections. And then when it really got going, so many women got involved because women had no rights at all. And they identified closely with African Americans. And the slave codes that were inscribed in the South during the colonial period and were taken over in the different states of the South, they were exactly the same codes as applied to the family code, the rights of women. No rights, basically no rights, no right to vote, no right to property, no right to inheritance, no right to divorce, no right to the children. If a woman left, she couldn't take the children. So they were very similar. None other than Hillary Rodham, when she was Hillary Rodham right here at Wellesley, wrote her senior thesis. And then when she went to law school, published it as a law review article on the comparison of the slave code and women's rights in the early 19th century. I don't think she talks about that much today. I only learned it because it was exposed when her husband was running for president. And I said, God, what happened to her anyway? You know, that was a great thesis. But I thought, you know, well, Why is it? I began thinking this in the civil rights movement, in the beginning of the anti-war movement. What came out of the abolitionist movement when they were trying to speak at Faneuil Hall and women got up to speak is they were arrested. Women were not allowed to speak in public. And so they fought that, and they fought that law and got the right for women to speak. And they called that movement feminism. At that time, in the 1830s, 1837, they started calling it feminism. And men could be feminists too. William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass always proudly said that they were feminists. And so I was thinking, as it became more and more apparent to me in the movement that women did all the work and men took the credit for it, and were the ones interviewed and on television and all, and the ones who supposedly did the theory that counted, that there really needed to be a women's movement like what came out of the abolitionist movement. So I helped start that in 1967, 68. Right here in Boston. South 16. I actually moved here. Now, you're going to think this is kind of foolish, but I was pretty young, and I was imbued with history. I was a graduate student. And I decided to come to Boston to start a women's liberation movement, as in my Hegelian mind, I was trying to become a Marxist, but I obviously had not gotten past Hegel, in thinking that somehow in the air here, the DNA, in the very moisture of things, that it would just come out if I said, women's liberation, feminism, all that history would just envelop all the women and there'd be this big women's liberation movement. Well, it wasn't exactly like that, but you know, we did really dig into the history here and use that a lot and get into women in the community that in other places the women's liberation movement really weren't able to attract, because they were mainly using the language of the, you know, 60s radical movement. And so I think history is very important. And it, as Howard did, you know, that it's not something that's just knowledge. I mean, that's good to have knowledge, but it's something that life that can be transmitted that strengthens us, because we're a part of all that. We're, the Foucauldians call it a genealogy, you know, our genealogy of who we are and who everything is. So anyway, this project I've been trying to promote for many years, and it's going on in a lot of places, and maybe it is here, you could hook up with it, or maybe someone thought of it, is to make a part of the Occupy movement. Because it's everywhere now. I just heard from my friend Esther Kingston Mann, who's my host here for an event tonight, and why I'm here, that where she lives in Arlington, they just started an Occupy Arlington mass. Yeah, so it's everywhere. You know, in Oklahoma, there are five in the two big cities, Tulsa and Oklahoma City, but also Stillwater and Chickasha, towns you've never heard of, I'm sure, Stroud. And in the Osage Nation, Oklahoma has a huge population of Native Americans. They're very involved in it. So I think if one project could be just to drill down and open up the history and go farther than 1620, go down to when this was indigenous people under this crust of the earth, are interred the bones, literally the bones of murdered people, of people subjected to genocide. And they should not be ignored, because it's ugly, because that's the roots of this whole country. And we can't really deny it. You know, we can't go on denying it. Richard Slotkin, a wonderful historian at Wesleyan, wrote a trilogy of books I highly recommend, all together about 2,000 pages, but worth it, let me tell you. The first one was called Regeneration Through Violence, in which he proposed the thesis that he was writing that during the Vietnam War, that first one, or right after the Vietnam War. Why this violence? You know, why does it seem every generation there's a war? Some of you don't even know about some of them, like the Marine occupation of Nicaragua and Haiti in the 1890s and into 1930s. Don't even know about it unless you've read Smedley Butler, who was one of the generals in Nicaragua. We say, oh, there was that little period of imperialism, and then it disappeared. And people were surprised with Iraq and Afghanistan. The U.S. is not imperialist, you know, it can't be. But you can only think that unless you have some curiosity about how a little strip of colonies hugging the East Coast, half of the East Coast of North America, went from there to the Pacific Ocean. How did that happen? Just fell from the sky? Is God willing, like the Puritans say and Ronald Reagan said? God did it. Militaries did it. This is the most militaristic country in human history. We didn't become more powerful than all militaries in human history put together by happenstance. And it started with the Indian Wars. It didn't start with the Civil War, not 1812, not the Revolutionary War. Where did George Washington get his soldier skills? He was an Indian fighter. He was a captain in the British Army killing Indians. I mean, that's how he became general. The others were businessmen. But he was the military man. So none of this is obvious when you're studying U.S. history. Indians know this because they know they can count and they can remember through their oral history everyone who died, every tribe that was wiped out or removed or shrunken. They have this knowledge, and fortunately, I have been given that knowledge. And a lot of people support Palestine today. It's very dear to my heart. It's such a mirror image of the United States. If you look at Palestine, everything that's happened, I know many of you know that, and you take that back to the 19th century in the United States, you'll find almost a duplication of the development of the reservation system in the United States, shrinking Indians down. You look at that map of Palestine today and how it's shrunken and is separated from each other, the different land bases. Looks like the reservation system. And so I think that would be a great project here, to drill down, not to try to do the whole thing, just do it here. Do it in Washington, D.C. Do it in Arlington. Do it in Oakland. Do it in Oklahoma City, everywhere. And come out with this incredible new history that could be put together. Much better than the book I'm working on, because I can't be that detailed in 300 pages. We can have this encyclopedia of true history, and that would be a real tribute to Howard Zinn. I swear he would come back if that were possible, if he could see that. So I just want to leave you with that thought today, and thank you so much for having me here. And I would love to hear any questions or comments. And if you can't be heard and I can't hear you, do come up and talk on the microphone, or we can take this out of here. Maybe take it a little ways, huh?
Should be.
You want to do that?
Yeah, I can come.
Because it's kind of windy and it's hard to hear. You want to take it?
Sure.
Don't be shy.
Yeah.
Maybe you could introduce yourself to
me. Hi, I'm Kathy Horsley from Berkeley, California. I'd like to ask Roxanne to tell us a little bit more about the free university system that she just mentioned briefly, something that is growing, at least in the bud stage.
Yes, and I'm trying to learn more about the free university here. We've actually started much smaller. We're calling it the Autonomous University of the Mission District, the Latino District. A lot of hipsters there too, and movement people and all. In ours, we're trying to, first of all, we're starting with the premise that everyone is an intellectual because everyone has a brain. And that some knowledge that's out there and some of us carry around and have from graduate school and all is probably not really necessary to have or necessary to transfer, but much of it is. And, or at least we can find what is, you know, what works, what will be received. We're also influenced by Ivan Illich and where I am. I don't know if you know about the period of the liberation theology and how language was a transmitter. They would bring all these Anglo-Americans down to Mexico, Cuernavaca, and teach them Spanish, but the content they were teaching was this amazing anti-imperialist content, rather than Joe and Jane went to the store, you know, or things like that, that how you usually learn language. So we get this idea of using language as a basis, but also we have a lot of, and I'm sure you do here too, day workers who are mostly Latino. And to make it a place where they can come and share their knowledge of their situation and where others who have education all can share their knowledge and also help provide English, because it's almost impossible to get into English classes. They're so backed up, all the, even the private firms, which are very expensive, but the junior college and all, who, and the programs that have language. So they say, why don't these people speak English? But, you know, they would love to. It would make their lives easier in the United States. But to also, through that, for the people doing it, to have an interchange. So this is the kind of basis of our project. It's probably a little different, but we only recently heard about the Free University in Boston, and my friend Esther is a part of it, and we want to learn more, because it doesn't mean there couldn't be many different kinds of projects.
Yeah. You don't have to use my computer.
Yeah, I can sort the camera. It's okay.
I wonder if you could say a few comments about the fact that it seems that the liberation theology premise has begun to work wonders in Latin America and South America. And many of those countries have been able to take back, take back their country from the small little elites and the giant corporations that basically run the world. Could you give us a little insight on how that maybe could be applied or begin to be applied, that kind of thinking and group thing to the United States?
Yeah, I'm getting warm. Taking off clothes. It's really important, you know, those of us who did, I did my doctorate in Latin American history, and so I was right at the time I started, 64, the Vatican II was in 1962, where Pope John announced for liberation in place of missionizing people to assist people in their liberation. And their largest missions were in Africa and Latin America. And so that was such a fantastic moment for so many priests and nuns and monks who felt restricted, were often kicked out because they were assisting people rather than just signing up new members to the Catholic Church. A lot of these were native people who practiced their own, you know, their own native religions. And I could see all through my graduate school, if I was following Latin America, the transformations taking place. And it had some influence in the United States, not all that much. It had influence on Native American reservations because they really emphasized Native people. So the Catholic missions were very active and Navajo Nation, the Lakota reservations in particular, the largest Native populations in the United States. So they began assisting. So when you saw the American Indian movement and the Wounded Knee and all, there was assistance. And then the other churches followed, the Protestant churches, the World Council of Churches, the National Council of Churches in the U.S. They followed in this liberation theology. So you saw quite a change and a good leadership qualities, not interference, but listening and then trying to get support, funding, whatever, for whatever the community saw need for. So when, you know, the Sandinista Revolution, the Salvadoran Revolution, the Guatemalan Revolutions in the 1970s and 80s, only Nicaragua triumphed. Later FMLN in Salvador is now in office by electoral ballot, which is just amazing. Guatemala hasn't really been able to develop a hegemony of radical politics. But all those were going on, and many of us got involved, many of us 60s veterans, and particularly those involved in Latin America, got involved. And I spent most of the 1980s in Nicaragua. And when the Contra War was going on, I did a book about that called Blood on the Border from South End, if you're interested. Native Americans were very involved in that. But their liberation theology came up. It hadn't really reached Central America as a very conservative, old guard Catholic institutions there, especially Nicaragua. And the bishop, Nicaragua, actually supported the Contras and excommunicated Ernesto Cardenal, who was in government, the Minister of Culture. So it made it very difficult for the Sandinistas going against the Catholic Church, and yet there was a tremendous support for them from, you know, the non-Nicaraguan Catholic Church. So it was one of the main sources of you know, the way the Contra War could be effective in destabilizing Nicaragua, and the Sandinistas got voted out in 1990. Because people were so tired of war, and there were really devout Catholics who did what the authorities told them to do, hate the Sandinistas. So liberation theology is not so well known in other circles, you know, the general movement. But I think the spirit of that, you know, that somehow it has, you know, there are many sources of that, like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, out of which came the Students for a Democratic Society, out of which came the Women's Liberation Movement, and all of that goes back to the preachers, the black preachers of the 50s who were involved, you know, were pre-liberation theology. The black church has always been a church of liberation. So that has seeped into our movement culture. So that I think, but now, I mean, it's what we've wanted, but this is the first time, I think, in my experience, like 50 years now, movement activism, that I've seen such a successful implementation of community and mutual assistance. Light and regard and respect and inclusion. So I really pay tribute to you for that. Everyone gets the mic. Since we don't have a few questions.
Well, my question's a little bit more personal. So thank you very much for your talking about history and having to drill down and not forgetting, because it affects how we do the present if we don't remember. And I'm involved with a collective that's doing something more recent, the history of the women's takeover of 888 Memorial Drive, which would be really known about if women's history was in the forefront. So we're working on a film right now, and I understand you were part of that takeover, and we want you to see the film. That's a work in progress right now, and I understand that you have something you're doing tonight. So I wonder how long you're going to be in Boston, if there's a way that we can work out. Because not only do we want to talk to you about the film, but there are people that we are using in the film, and we don't recognize them. And we're hoping that if we can organize a time while you're still in Boston, or another way of showing you the film, if I can have a way of contacting you, you can really help us preserve our history in a very concrete way by helping us with Left on Pearl, Women Take Over 888 Memorial Drive. And so maybe afterwards I can just get a contact for you. And the other thing I want to ask you is it possible that you came to Brandeis in about 1968? Because if you did, you were the first feminist I ever had heard talk. And I remember leaving the talk and being so makes so much sense. I so agree. Oh my God, so clear. But women needing to do self-defense is a little extreme.
That was me, I think.
Yes, I thought so.
When you said the self-defense, I said that. We were notoriously, my little group, I guess because we were mostly working class, and we had a couple of African Americans from Roxbury, and several prostitutes in our group. We were an unusual group. And then women on welfare who were with the National Welfare Rights Organization, very militant. I'll tell you a story, and remind me to tell you a story about them. But then we had a couple of students, and we had a variety. But when we were, it was a period of time, maybe it still is, but in Boston especially, the media made, there were a lot of killings in the summer of 1968. And they were horrible killings, and they were probably mostly prostitutes. They were women who would be found, and they were looking for this guy. I don't think they ever found him. But the body count went up every day, and it was just so offensive. And one headline was, "More Slain Girls." These were women, they weren't girls. But that was a headline, so we took off on that and wrote a leaflet and did work around it and everything. And then, you know, women got scared. And I lived in Cambridgeport, which at that time was, you know, a kind of working class district, Central Square. And right below that were all these factories where a lot of women worked. There were factories one time here. Maybe there still are, but. We started doing patrols. We would go down, we were imitating the Black Panthers. We would go down and ask women if they wanted us to walk them home. And sometimes, you know, because we had our combat boots on, and, you know, it's like, sometimes they looked more scared of us. But we learned how to do it better. And then we thought, well, what would we do, you know, if someone attacked? I mean, we have numbers, but so. We decided, we had met up with someone who was taking Taekwondo. And so we actually, this very right-wing South Korean who ran the place here in Boston, we actually talked him into allowing us free for a set sum a month, which wasn't very much, like $50 or something, for an all-women's class that he would teach. And he would first do extra time teaching two women so they could start teaching us. We have all women class. He actually did that. I still think it's pretty amazing that he did that. But he really wanted to push his studio, and it gave him publicity. And we got a lot of publicity around the Amazons learning Taekwondo. This is the fiercest form of self-defense. This isn't karate or judo. This is killer martial arts. And so we learned it. I was very bad at it myself, you know, and didn't do too well, but several were just, I mean, they protected me a couple of times. And then when we went, we dressed properly, and we actually had a couple of confrontations with men in which we were the winners. And so we start teaching, you know, a lot of our organizing was around getting women into this class. And actually trying to make women understand that they could stand up for themselves. They didn't have to call the police for protection. And they didn't have to allow their husbands to beat them. And I thought it was, I think it'd be good to revive it.
Yeah.
Maybe not Taekwondo, but, you know, martial arts for women. They do it in China. They start teaching those little girls. I was over there for the UN Women's Conference in 95, and they gave a demonstration. These were three-year-old girls, black belts. I mean, they were amazing, and they had a whole scene where they beat all the boys. You know, it was planned, but all the boys were on the floor after. And they, a woman minister from Kenya was sitting next to me, and she said, I'm going home and implementing this. She's the education minister. And so I think it does. It just changes everything when women can stand up for themselves. Anyway, we did talk about that a lot at the time.
An area in which I think progressives have been failing for many generations now is with youth. I know that back in the late 60s, like Norman Solomon, for example, you probably know him, he created his own free high school back in 1968 in Washington, D.C. I'm a graduate. But I don't feel as if we're carrying through with that. You know, right now, we're losing the battles over the school boards. And this is something that ultra-right-wing groups have recognized, is that if they can take over the school boards, they get to the kids young. And I don't think, I was just wondering if you have any ideas of how perhaps we can defend the children and bring them you know, into the movement better than we have been doing.
Well, I think it was the biggest mistake we made in the 60s, and I say we, is maybe thinking we were too good or thought of bigger things than to go and get elected to school boards in every district in the country. But the John Birch Society that formed in the 1950s, a very right-wing, right-wing is possible to get without being the Nazi party. But a businessman, I mean, the candy man, Welch Candies heir, a businessman. They were mostly businessmen, and that was their plan. And that built up into the Goldwater, you know, the John Birch Society got out the troops. And after Goldwater didn't win the election in 1964, they made this plan to you could call it infiltrate, but basically get elected to school boards everywhere. And if they didn't have someone there, to send someone to that place. And it's not hard to get elected to, it is now, but it wasn't then hard to get elected. And they've changed, you know, the curriculum, they didn't succeed so well in Northern California, but they decide, you know, the standards and the textbooks and the Texas school boards now, where they really attack, now control, their vote controls the final vote on what will be in textbooks, U.S. history textbooks. So it's really serious. And then they started attacking the unions, you know, because generally teachers are pretty liberal and are truth seekers, you know, and imaginative. And so the, you know, union busting, which they're getting along. So we're kind of at a place where, can we defend public education? I mean, you have the richest man in the world, Bill Gates, pushing for charters and speaking out. I saw him on CNN this morning. You know, I said, why don't we just appoint this man president, and then we'll know who the enemy is, and we can overthrow him, you know, because he's calling all the shots now, you know, with his completely screwball liberal, neoliberal ideas. And he has the money, you know, and the prestige to do it. So I think these are things we have to be talking about, because we didn't do that
we don't have the presence there, the school boards. Like I say, in San Francisco, and I'm sure some other places, maybe in Boston, are better off because liberals did get involved in the, our Tom Amiano, who's now a state assemblyman, did amazing things in the 80s as the head of the school board in San Francisco. And especially with GLBT rights, he was a gay man, and anti-racism and women's inclusion. But in most places, especially in the middle of the country, it's just devastating. You know, the lack of knowledge, censorship of books in the libraries. I know in the Bay Area, we have a little caucus of radicals who are anarchists, radical anarchists, who are working out, you know, guides to childcare, anarchist childcare. And you can, you know, I'll give you my card or anyone else who wants it to contact me or remind me, and I'll send you the website for that. They put out a few little pamphlets for parents, and their meetings are getting larger and larger. I think they said that there were some others popping up. They have good connections around the country, you know, from the globalization movement and all. These were people who came out of the Battle of Seattle, you know. So, but that's with, you know, very small children. There's still the problem of schools, you know. And I don't know if we should... Elementary schools, is really difficult. I mean, when you get to the university, we have a lot more, still have a lot more freedom, although it's diminishing because they're just...